in human relationships, knowing somebody's way, how that person does certain things, is important. When Jenny and I first married, we clashed often because we came from two different backgrounds and we came from two different families. For example, the way we cut fruits was different. When I cut an apple, for example, I do it what they call the Korean style. I take a knife and then I go around the world, swirl around the world, and make the peel as thin as possible, taking as much flesh as I can. Janet, when she cuts an apple, she cuts it bulk style. So she cuts it like she cuts a paper, you know, with a bulk cutter, cutting off so much of the flesh off of it. And I'm thinking, oh, if my grandma was there, she'll be yelling at you, right? Wasting so much food. I'm sorry, not that that's bad, but that's just your style. It's a lot faster, by the way. Okay, so I can give her that. The way we argue or how we resolve conflict is also different. Me, I want to talk it out. I don't want the sun to set on our bad feelings toward each other, right? So let's talk it out. Let's resolve it. But her, I need space, right? Leave me alone for a night. And then she goes to sleep. And the next morning, it's as if nothing happened. We don't even need to talk about it. So after I learned that, it's like, you know what? I'm just going to give her space, let her go to her scrapbook room, and then do her thing. And then next morning, she's all smiley as if nothing happened. So that works, right? And so depending on your background, how we resolve things and how we do things are different. And it's good to know, important to know somebody's way, how they operate in order to have a close relationship with that person. So when it comes to our relationship with God, because it is a personal relationship with God, we need to know how God operates as well, because he has his own distinct way of doing things. But in human relationships, we adjust to each other's ways, right? So there really isn't a right way, the wrong way. You know, we just have to accommodate for one another. But when our relationship with God, when it comes to that, well, God is absolute and we are not. And so we are the one who have to adjust, and God is the one who is always right. And so we should know how he operates so that we can adjust to his way so that things will go for us and things will go for me individually as well. Okay, so what we're going to do today is we're going to look at how God operates, looking at the story that Kaliah began to read. Actually, the whole chapter of John chapter 11 is dedicated to this one story. And so let me give you a little background, and then I'm going to go over seven distinct ways that God operates on. Okay? So the background is this. So Jesus had friends named Lazarus, Mary, and Martha. Mary is not Jesus' mother at this point. Okay? Mary was a very popular name, so it was a different Mary. However, they were siblings, so brother and sisters. One day, Lazarus got sick, and Jesus had personal acquaintance with this family, and they lived in a town called Bethany, which was only a couple miles away from Jerusalem, the capital city of Israel, and Jesus often stayed at their place whenever he would visit Jerusalem. So they were very well acquainted, and they were kind of friends. They were buddies along with Jesus. And so when Lazarus fell ill, and I'm sure he was gravely ill, the sisters sent word to Jesus. They knew where he was, and they sent a word to Jesus, maybe through a servant, that their beloved brother Lazarus is sick, expecting Jesus to come, hurry up and come, and heal him, because they know and they have witnessed that Jesus healed many sick people, even perfect strangers, and so it was perfectly all right for them to expect Jesus to come and heal their brother. However, Jesus delays two extra days. And by the time Jesus finally gets to Bethany to face Lazarus, which takes another 2 days, he's been dead for 4 days. He's been in the tomb for 4 days. The sisters are aghast, as you can tell, right? Why weren't you here, Jesus? If you had been here earlier, our brother would not have died. Why weren't you here healing our brother? Of course, you can hear the resentment and so on, and we're going to get more into that. But Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life, and you will see a miracle today. And then he asks the sisters where they had laid him. Where is Lazarus' tomb? Let me go there. And he goes there, and then he shouts, Lazarus, come out. And then in that zombie movie style, literally, Lazarus, walking dead, comes out with the linen strips all over him hanging out because he just has been raised from the dead. And everybody who came along with Jesus to see what was going on glorifies God. And of course, the family glorifies God as well. End of the story. So with that story, and a lot of you are familiar already with the story, so I went rather quickly, but I know that there are some of you who are not familiar with the story at all. So I told you the background upon which these principles actually happen. Okay? So what can we learn about God's way through this story? How does God operate? Number one, His way is not our way. His way is different than human ways. Isaiah 55:8 says this, "For my thoughts," this is God speaking, "for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." And we see this in this episode with Jesus, right? His dealings with the ones he particularly loved. Jesus throws everybody off, right? The sisters, and he even throws disciples off on this one, treating the one that he supposedly loved in this way. Because the human way is, when you hear that somebody is sick and you are the doctor and you could do something about this sickness, what do you expect him to do? You expect him to hurry up, drop everything, go to him, heal his sickness so that he won't die. But Jesus doesn't. And the Bible is making the point that once he knew that Lazarus was sick, the one he loved, he delayed two extra days. Like, boggles your mind. What? Doesn't make sense. And that tells us right away that his way is not our way. He does things differently than as you and I would as humans. Okay? And we're going to look at some of these different ways. Number two, his way deals with the fundamental problem and not just the surface problem. The way he deals with things is different because he usually deals with the fundamental problem, the base, the core problem, and not the surface problem. What the sisters and all the townspeople, they were expecting Jesus to do was to heal his sickness, Lazarus's sickness. He was ill. However, if you think about it, the sickness is not really the fundamental problem, right? Why do we worry about getting sick? Now, most of you have insurance, right? Obamacare, and so all of us have to have health insurance, right? And some of you get a checkup every year, right? Or physical checkup before you sign up for sports and so on. And these are good things, and some of you exercise and what have you, right? And then you guys take, you know, vitamins and so on, you know, so that you won't get sick when there's a cold going around. Why do we do all of this? We're not so much worried about getting sick, but what are we really worried about? We're worried about dying. Right? Sickness can lead to death. And death really is the fundamental problem. Sickness is really a peripheral, a surface problem. And Lazarus, his problem was really not the sickness. The reason why they sent word to Jesus is because he must have been very gravely sick, so much so that they thought that he might die. And he did die. However, when Jesus heard that Lazarus was sick, what did he do? What he did is he waited until the surface problem became the fundamental problem, because he is into solving our fundamental problem and not just our surface problem. So he literally waits until this surface problem, not that big a deal, becomes a big deal, because he's going to do a miracle with this, right? And so God, when he deals with our problems, he often deals and waits until our surface problem becomes our fundamental problem. In this case, death. But if you really think about it, even death, physical death, isn't our core, most basic problem, is it? Because everybody dies. We know that, right? Every single one of us in here in about 80 years won't be here. Right? Maybe just a couple of you infants, right, will still be here. But in 80 years' time, none of us will be alive. So death really is not the fundamental, the core, right? Bottom, ultimate problem. What is the ultimate problem? It's eternal death. Eternal separation from God. A lot of you are here. Why? Because you believe in the life after death, right? If this life is all there is, let's enjoy our lives, right? We only have 60, 70, 80 years, right? And only maybe 40 years of it you can truly enjoy, because I'm hitting 50, right? In a couple of years, man, my body is aching everywhere. I'm already not enjoying myself very much. I'm like, I want a new body, right? I wish I were 19. So if you're like 19, I mean, enjoy it now, because you will be feeling it very soon. So this life is not going to last very long. We're all going to die, right? So really the fundamental problem that we have to deal with is this eternal life, right? Eternal death. That we are afraid of hell. And that is why, frankly, a lot of us are here. We don't want to go to hell, just in case that there is such thing as hell. And we know that Jesus is the only way. And I think that's okay. As long as you don't stay that way, that you're only coming to Jesus, right? And continue to come to Jesus because you're afraid of hell, rather than coming to Jesus for Jesus. But the fundamental problem really is the eternal death, right? And Jesus was here to solve even that, the eternal death issue. So his way is different in that way. Number three, his way, God's way, will incite doubt and suspicion by us at times. If you're following God's ways, sometimes you will have doubts about God's way. Was that really the best way? I could see another way that could possibly be better than how God made that happen. And that's exactly what the sisters were thinking. Both of them say exactly the same thing when they see Jesus one at a time. They did not come to meet Jesus at the same time, but Martha came and met Jesus first, and then Mary comes and meets Jesus later on. And they say exactly the same thing word for word, and that is, Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Makes perfect sense, right? Jesus, we saw you heal perfect strangers. You don't even know their name, and you go and then let you be healed, right? And be healed, and you heal them. But one that you love, you have stayed at our house, Jesus. We have a personal relationship with you. We are like friends to you. And then we send word and our brother is sick. You don't even come. You stay there extra days. What's up, Jesus? Right? You can hear some resentment. Maybe hurt, definitely hurt in their voices as they said this. And you know, another thing is that I'm really bad at this. Jesus could have communicated at the least, right? If he couldn't come, maybe he was doing something more important, right? He could have sent word to the sisters, you know what? I'm going to come, but here's my plan, okay? I'm going to stay here for 2 extra days. And during the time, your brother is going to die. I'm just telling you. But don't worry, because I'm going to come 2 days after that. So in 4 days, I'm going to come. I'm going to go to your brother's gravesite, and then I'm going to raise him from the dead. All right? So that's what's going to happen. That's a game plan. So chill. If he had communicated it to the sisters, and they could have, oh, okay. So that's what's going to do. All right. So let's not worry. Even if he dies, we're cool. Right? But Jesus doesn't say a word. The sisters are in the dark as to what Jesus' plan was and why he did what he did. And so they couldn't help but to have some kind of doubt in their minds, a suspicion, does he really love us or not? And you know, that's how God operates. And that's what the scripture says, right? It's showing an example that his way is not always, he doesn't always explain everything to us. Sometimes he keeps us in the dark, and sometimes we don't know exactly why God does the way he does and what he does. But that's the way he works. Most of the time, he does not explain to us. Why does he not explain things to us? My guess would be, at least one of the answers to that, is because it has something to do with faith and building our character. Right? If we only go with God's way, if everything makes sense to us because God explained everything to us, what kind of faith would we need? We wouldn't, right? Oh, okay, that's what you're going to do. Oh, that's why you're doing it. That makes sense. Okay, I would do the same thing if I were in your position, God. What faith would be required in a situation like that, right? But we don't know exactly why. We think there is a better way to handle this situation, and yet God is not granting it. You know what? At that point, you got to choose. Am I going to believe that God's way is best and he's doing this because he loves me? Or am I going to believe that, well, God doesn't care about me or he doesn't exist, right? So you really have to exercise your faith, and I think that has a lot to do with it. Okay, so Pastor Ong, basically, you're telling us to, you're advocating blind faith then, right? Faith is blind. Just believe. Is that what I'm saying? No, That's not what I'm saying. I don't believe faith is blind at all. I think faith is seeing the unseen, seeing the unseeable. Here's my definition of faith, okay? Faith is not just believe. Okay, even if it doesn't make sense, just believe. No. Faith is basing upon what we know, what God has shown to us, trusting Him for what we don't know in the future. Faith is based upon what God has already shown to us in His Word and in our experience, trusting Him for the unforeseen future. That's what faith is, and that's what trust is, right? You don't go into, you don't hop into a car of a stranger, but if you have known this person and you've seen this person, right? And then that person says, hey, hop in. What do? We hop in, right? Why? Because we had that previous experience with that person. We know that this person is trustworthy. And that's why the Bible is so thick. It's giving us evidence after evidence of how God worked in the past so that we look at it and go, you know what? If God has done this for all these people, I can trust Him for my future as well. That's what faith is. And sometimes God tells us to exercise our faith when we don't know if His method is truly the best way. So His way will sometimes incite doubt and suspicion by us at times. Number four, I'll be very brief, and it goes with number three, and that is His way makes sense in retrospect only, and usually not while it's going on. So the disciples, as well as the sisters, the family, they were totally confused as to what Jesus was doing, right? They couldn't figure it out. Even the disciples, who was Jesus, when he heard the word from the sisters, Jesus told them, Lazarus is sleeping, and I'm going to go wake him up. And disciples thought, oh, if he's sleeping, then let him sleep, Jesus, right? He's going to get better. But when they went, actually, with Jesus to Bethany, they found out that Lazarus had been dead for 4 days. And so imagine if you were in the shoe of the disciples, right? Wait a minute, Jesus said he was sleeping, but he's actually dead. And Jesus also said that he's going to wake him up, but he's dead. How is he going to wake up a dead person? Totally confused, right? But in retrospect, after they had witnessed Lazarus rising from the dead, everything made sense to the disciples as well as to the sisters, right? Why he delayed for 2 extra days? Because Jesus wasn't simply going to solve their surface problem, but he was going to solve their primary, right, fundamental problem of death. That he's not just a healer, but he literally is the resurrection. That he has control, power over death and life. That's what he wanted to show them. And it made perfect sense to them in retrospect, afterwards, right, in hindsight. But it didn't make sense to them while it was going on. So obvious application, right? Sometimes God brings us through a dark tunnel, and we don't know why God does what he does. We don't know why he kind of chooses and makes things happen to us. We cannot know, but it will become crystal clear to us one day. Maybe not in this life, but when we are definitely in heaven. We're going to look at that, and you go, that's why God did what he did. Now I see why he allowed that kind of illness in my family. I understand now why he let me lose my loved one when I was such and such age. I understand now why I got into that accident and I became crippled. That makes sense. That makes sense. Tim Keller has said this. He said, we would answer all of our prayers, okay, exactly the same way that God would answer our prayers if we knew what God knew. In other words, you know the prayers that don't get answered and we don't understand why? We would have perfect understanding on why God did not answer those prayers if we knew what God knew. Right? If we had omniscience, right, all knowledge, and if we knew the future, present, and how it's going to happen, then we would answer it the exact same way that he answered, the ones that we have doubts about. That makes sense, right? And I think one day we'll see it clearly, but not yet, because we're not there yet. So his way makes perfect sense in retrospect, usually only, and usually not while it's going on. Number five, his way is often to delay granting our request. Our way is usually right now. We hate that, don't we? We don't like delay. We want instant, right? One commentator said this about this whole story, how Jesus delayed for two extra days. He said, humans generally interpret any delay in rendering help as cruel because of our perspectives on the avoidance of all pain and because of our general commitment to the immediacy of action as it pertains to time. But cruelty is hardly what this story is about. Imagine you took your child to the emergency room, right? He's choking. And then the emergency medical crew did not do anything and just sits there and your child dies. What do you do next? Sue, right? For millions of dollars because they are at fault. You could have done something about my child. You didn't. Why not? And that's how the sisters felt about what Jesus did. You could have come and healed our brother. Why didn't you? Right? Jesus delayed. Their timing was right now before he dies. But God's timing was, I'm going to wait until he dies. And then I'm going to bring him back from the dead. His timing was completely different. To us, he's always too late. God is always too late, but he's never too late. His timing is perfect because God is not only in control of our events, but he's also in control of our time. He's there in the present, future, and the past all at the same time. Right? That's who God is. You know, we're like little children who want things right away. When we were little, do you remember, if you guys are like over 30 or 40, right? Do you remember when you were little that your parents always took forever to do anything? When they say right now, they mean like an hour or two, right? When you say as a child right now, like you mean like that instant. But when they say right now, they mean like an hour or two. And that just used to frustrate me. So I didn't believe that. I didn't trust them. But now my children say the same thing to me. Daddy, when you say right now, like you mean like way later. Like when you say just a brief, short time, you mean like an hour. And that makes sense, right? Because as we age, our time, the concept of time gets stretched as well, right? So it's a funny thing, right? I was talking with a youth one day, and she was telling me something about, like something happened long time ago, right? She did something, and then this was a long time ago that this happened. So I asked her, so how long ago? 6 months. So 6 months to her, maybe a 15-year-old was a long time ago. But to me, 6 months, I mean, like, maybe 10 years is a long time ago, right? But not 6 months. 6 months is like yesterday. Why? Because I'm old, right? And the concept of time is different from a child. So imagine how God would see time. He's infinity years old, right? And so, yeah, how would he see time compared to us? Peter says in 2 Peter 3:8, with the Lord, one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. The Lord is not slow to fulfill his promise, as some count slowness, but is patient towards you, not wishing that any should perish, that all should reach repentance. His timing is perfect. Our timing is the one that's off. Number six. His way is sure to bring about good. Our way is at best precarious. That means may or may not bring about ultimate goodness. But his way will always bring about goodness because God knows the future. He controls the future, but we don't. What we go for today, because we thought would be good for us, isn't good for us. So many of us, right, in America, we fall in love, right? And we date for 5 months, and then we get married, thinking that I'll be happy forever. 2 years later, you're signing that divorce paper, thinking that you made the worst mistake of your life, right? The greatest mistake of your life. We were so sure just 5 months ago that this person will change my life, and this is the best decision I've ever made. But a few years later, this is the worst mistake. Why did I do that? Why couldn't I see that, right? That's human beings. That's human perspective. There's a story of Chinese farmer, old saying that goes like this. A Chinese farmer lost his horse that ran off from his farm one day, and his neighbors came and said, oh, very bad luck, right? And the farmer said, bad luck, good luck, who knows? A week later, this horse that ran away actually came back with a bunch of wild horses. And so neighbor seeing this, oh, good luck. But the farmer said, good luck, bad luck, who knows. A week later, the son of the farmer was trying to break in one of the horses. And while riding, he got thrown off and he broke his leg. And so the neighbors, of course, came around, right? Nosy, being like Asians, you know, like all of us, said, oh, bad luck. And the farmer said again, bad luck, good luck, who knows. A week later, the government officials came around in the village and they were conscripting all able-bodied young men to go into the mandatory army military service. But seeing that the son had a broken leg, they did not conscript him into that assignment. So the neighbors all came and said, oh, good luck. And you can guess what the farmer said, right? Good luck, bad luck, who knows? That's human perspective. What we thought was good turns out bad. Or what we thought was bad turns out good. So who really knows? However, it's not precarious like that with God. Because God controls the future, right? He knows, not only knows, but he controls the future. So he doesn't say, good luck, bad luck, who knows? No, God works all things for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. God can take anything, however evil or bad it is, and he's going to turn it into a good thing. So good things are good things to God. Bad things are good things to God because he's omnipotent like that. He's sovereign like that. Right? So that's a different perspective, isn't it? His way is sure to bring about the good. Our way is precarious at best. Last one, number 7. Our way of life is to avoid suffering. God's way of life is through suffering. This one is hard. None of us wants to suffer, right? We want to avoid suffering at all costs. Most of our prayers, if you're honest, Lord, keep us safe. Give us traveling mercies. I just pray that for Mr. and Mrs. Lee. Heal my mother. Guide the surgeon's hands. Right? Be with the nurse or what have you, right? Protection, safety, comfort, peace. Why? Because we don't want to suffer. We hate suffering. I hate suffering. But it seems that God's way is often that he achieves his purpose through suffering more than through avoiding suffering. We've seen it through his beloved friends, Lazarus, Mary, and Martha, today. We've seen it through Paul's life. We've seen it in Job. And most of all, we've seen it in God's Son, Jesus, who suffered more than anybody else. Peter nails it in 1 Peter 4:12. He said, beloved, by the way, this is being spoken by one who was crucified upside down, the most painful way to go, right? Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed. This is my rule of thumb on how I measure greatness, one's greatness. The one who has suffered the most for Christ is great in my eyes. Not the one who has passed up on all suffering, not the one who has lived the most successful and most comfortable life that is great in my eyes, but the one who has suffered the most for Christ's sake is the one who is great in my eyes, and I believe in God's eyes as well. And this is totally the opposite of how the prosperity gospel's preacher, right, preaches these days, right? If you go to any of the mainline big churches, right, these days, what you will hear is that if you are faithful, if you serve God, if you give, right, if you live a moral life, then God's going to love you and he's going to prevent all evil things from happening to you so that you will not suffer. He's going to give you health, wealth, and prosperity and none of the diseases. And to that, I say, which Bible are you reading? Right? What Bible? You and I are not reading the same Bible. Jesus, the greatest man ever, the Son of God, died the most cruel death at age 33. Let me summarize all of this in one sentence. There's a common thread that weaves through all these ways of God. There's one thing, only one thing that God is trying to achieve through working this way, and that is God's way is to give us more of himself. God's way is to give us more of himself and not simply his gifts. His gifts will follow, probably not in this world, but certainly in the next world. But really, the greatest gift is that the gift of himself. Let me quote Piper and I'll end. Piper said, "Don't measure the love of God for you by how much health and wealth and comfort he brings into your life. If that were the measure of God's love, then he hated the Apostle Paul and Jesus. Measure God's love for you by how much of himself he shows you, how much of himself he gives you to know and enjoy." So if you're suffering, even though you have been faithful, he's treating you as his child. If you're suffering, even though you have been faithful, not perfectly faithful, because we're all sinful still, then he is treating you like his child. Rejoice in it. He's disciplining me. He's letting me taste what his son has gone through. He's drawing me to himself rather than spoiling me, right, with health, wealth, and prosperity and making sure everything goes well for my sake so that I'll go straight to hell and I will never seek God, because if everything is going well, why would I seek God, right? But he put all these things in my life that I may not like right now, but he's drawing me to him. Praise God. Thank God. That's a sign that I am a child of God. This life will soon be passed, but only what's done for Christ will last, right? And he's drawing me and you to himself even through suffering. So stay faithful, even rejoice in it. Let's pray.